step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
With Lucky Land slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
This is continuing coverage in the trial of Alex Murdaugh from True Crime Today.
Our coverage continues now. Segment number 4 of courtroom coverage today. Day number 8 in the trial of Alex Murdaugh. Let's go there now.
Thank you. I may call your next witness.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please report?
Yes, sir.
State calls Paul Greer.
Do you swear from the testimony you're about to give the court to be the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Okay, please have a seat in the witness stand. Repeat your name and spell your last name for the record.
My name is Paul Greer, G-R-E-E-R.
Paul, how are you doing today?
I'm great, thank you.
Take a moment to unpack your stuff if you need to. Paul, if you would, please introduce yourself to the jury and tell us a little bit when you graduated high school and where you went for education.
Sure. My name is Paul Greer. I am originally from the upstate of South Carolina, went to school and graduated high school in 2009. Upon graduating high school, I attended the University of South Carolina and received a Bachelor's of Science in Biological Sciences from the University of South Carolina.
Thank you, Paul. I'm going to ask you, if you would, to pull that microphone a little closer so we can all hear you.
Yes, sir.
Thank you. All right, Paul, walk us through a little bit about your career. With whom are you currently employed?
I'm employed at the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, which is commonly known as SLED.
All right, and tell us a little bit about your professional career. How did you get started at SLED, and what is it that you do there?
Yes, sir. After completing my Bachelor of Science at USC, I began an internship at SLED in the Forensic Services Laboratory. I specifically did that internship with our Fire and Tool Mark Department. I interned there for several months and ultimately achieved a position there in that unit. I began my employment officially at SLED in March of 2014 in the firearms department, where I began training to become a firearms examiner.
All right, and are you currently employed as a firearms examiner with SLED?
Yes, sir.
All right, Paul, Mr. Greer, if you would, walk us through what that required in order to become a firearms examiner.
Sure. In order to become a firearms examiner, there's a lot of extensive training on the job that must be conducted. At SLED, I began an in-house training program that we refer to as the Firearm and Toolmark Course of Instruction. During this time, again, it was extensive, approximately 3 years or so. I assisted other examiners who were qualified on the job, prep their cases. I learned how to work those cases. I looked at thousands of fired ammunition components on the microscope and did many comparisons of those. During that time, I also completed multiple written and practical examinations. At the conclusion of that training program, I was given a comprehensive final exam that included some mock casework within our laboratory. I successfully completed all of that training and that mock casework and was able to begin working cases on my own.
In addition to the comprehensive qualifications and testing required to become a forensic examiner, are forensic examiners in SLED also subject to yearly testing as well?
Yes, sir. We do the competency at the conclusion of our training program, but we also participate in proficiency testing each year within an area in our discipline. So that is completed. I complete a proficiency test each year, and that just assures that we're maintaining our competency.
Thank you. Paul, are you a member of any professional organizations?
Yes, sir, I am.
And which one would that be?
I'm a member of the Association of Firearm and Toolmark Examiners, which is also known as AFTE.
Have you had any opportunity to attend additional trainings or conferences under the umbrella of firearms and toolmark examinations?
Yes, sir, I have.
Could you please explain a couple of those or a few of those, if you would?
Yes, sir. AFTE hosts an annual conference each year. And AFTE, I might add, is an international organization. It's a group of firearms and toolmark examiners around the world, as well as other scientists and members from the academic world. We get together each year, and I attend that when I'm able, in order to share information and see what's happening within the field of firearm and toolmark examination. I've attended several of those conferences, and I've also attended some regional conferences that have been hosted by the FBI laboratory in Quantico.
And speaking of laboratories, is your laboratory accredited?
Yes, sir, it is.
And what is the accreditation it operates under?
The SLED laboratory is accredited under ANAB. That is a national organization that follows ISO 17025 standards, and those are international standards. So our laboratory is operating within the same set of standards as other labs in the United States that are accredited with ANAB and also those who follow the ISO 17025.
And in order to maintain accreditation, is there an inspection process that ANAB requires?
Yes, sir.
All right, and explain, if you would, the kind of the couple of inspections that are typically required.
In order to maintain our accreditation, we have a visit approximately every 4 years. Auditors come in to the laboratory to check our casework, review our files, make sure that we're operating within those standards, and they watch us perform casework. That's a big, huge component, and they do this for all of the disciplines within the laboratory. And that audit every 4 years within that cycle helps to ensure that we're meeting those standards. Internally at SLED, we also have internal audits each year. So even though the ANAB inspectors that come every 4 years, we may not see them every year, there is some type of audit being performed within our departments and in our casework each year.
Thank you. Does the SLED laboratory operate under a policies and procedures guideline for the overall agency?
Yes, sir, we do.
All right, and explain a little bit about how that involves the lab.
Correct. SLED in general has a large set of policies that we must adhere to. Within the laboratory, each department has a manual that they must follow that gives them information on how to conduct their everyday work and how to perform casework. Additionally, and following the ANAB accreditation, we have a SLED quality manual that is specifically for the laboratory. We must follow that as well. And those are all guidelines to help us within to conduct casework.
And in addition to the SLED quality assurance manual, would there additionally be a SLED firearms department manual that you have to comply with?
Yes, sir. There is a firearms manual that we must follow.
Okay. Just very briefly, please explain what that involves.
Yes, sir. That again is just a document that gives us information on how to conduct our day-to-day casework, what to do with evidence, how we should examine that. It also gives us information into our training program, any type of calibration or measurement references that we need to consult for our equipment that we use. All of that information is contained within that manual that we have to follow and can reference.
All right, and if you would, please explain to the jury what firearms identification, generally the subject matter, what that is.
Sure. Firearms identification is a discipline in forensic science where our main objective each day is to examine those fired ammunition components. So imagine a fired cartridge case or a fired bullet, and we're looking at those in order to determine if they were fired by a specific firearm.
Thank you. How long have you been working in SLED, in the SLED laboratory?
I've been employed in the firearms department at SLED for almost 9 years.
And have you had an opportunity to testify in court such as this?
I have.
Would that be both state and federal courts?
I have testified in state and federal courts, yes, sir.
Okay. Approximately how many times, or do you know how many times?
Approximately 27 times, yes, sir.
Your Honor, at this point, state moves to admit Mr. Greer as a firearms and tool mark examination expert.
Your Honor, no objections to his qualifications.
He's so qualified.
Thank you, Your Honor. All right, Mr. Greer, I'd like to take the moment to kind of educate the jury a little bit on firearms.
Yes, sir.
And if you would, please tell us a little bit about the, first of all, are you familiar with the two kind of cartridge rounds we're going to primarily be talking about today?
Yes, sir.
And are you familiar with the two kind of firearms we're going to generally be talking about today?
Yes, sir, I am.
All right. If you would, please give us a little, an intro to firearms, beginning with perhaps a shotgun. Tell us what makes that a unique type of firearm and how it generally operates.
Yes, sir. In general, a firearm is a mechanism that propels a projectile through the combustion of gunpowder. As he was stating, there are several different types of firearms, and one of them is a shotgun. A shotgun, if you imagine, is a long gun, typically that is designed to be fired from the shoulder. That has a smooth bore. And what the bore is, it's just the inside of that barrel, so there's no rifling inside that barrel typically. A shotgun is also different than maybe a handgun that you may be familiar with, and it fires shot shells. And a shot shell is a cartridge, if you will, that could be plastic or metal that can contain multiple projectiles or a single projectile.
And when you said barrel, smooth bore, and rifling, would rifling mean sort of the interior of the barrel where the bullet exits is spiraled inside?
Correct. That rifling is in barrels in order to give a bullet that's traveling down that barrel its rotary twist and spin so that way it can travel to a target or its destination.
And does that rifling assist in the bullet traveling in a straight line consistently?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
The rifling, spinning the bullet, making it go out, does that allow it to travel in a straight line?
Yes, that rifling that's inserted into that barrel, if you'll think of kind of like a quarterback throwing a football, it helps it give it that nice spiral so that it can travel more efficiently.
And kind of the opposite of that would be the smooth bore of a shotgun. How does that affect the pellets or the BBs inside of the shotgun?
So in a typical shotgun, you don't have that rifling that gives it that spin or twist, but that's not the design of the shotgun. So when those pellets are a slug or whatever is traveling down the bore of that shotgun, it is just traveling out the barrel based on the combustion from it firing.
Okay. And if you would please describe to us what type of ammunition a shotgun will shoot.
Typically, you use a shot shell. That can be made of some type of plastic, typically we see that, with some type of metal head on it. Inside that shot shell, there can be multiple projectiles. You hear of pellets, we think of birdshot, buckshot. That's what would be inside of a shot shell. Also in there may be other components that could be plastic or some type of paper material, and that would be a wad. And those have different jobs within a shot shell. Those can be to protect the pellets, to keep them together as they travel, to provide some type of cushioning between those pellets and the powder. So they all have different various purposes within inside that shot shell.
And, Mr. Greer, did you bring with you some demonstrative items to kind of just demonstrate generically what you're talking about in a shot shell?
Yes, sir.
All right, can I see that real quick?
Yes, sir.
Greer, if you would, begin with the shot shells. You brought some demonstrative exhibits, is that correct?
That's correct.
If you would, just please hold them up, show them to the jury, and explain what it is we see, what we're looking at, and what the components are in there.
Sure. Again, these are just two examples of a shot shell. Here you have a plastic body there of the shell with a metal head. On this end of it, that is the end that's going to be up against the breech face of the firearm. And in the middle, you'll see a small circle. That's the primer area, and that's what's going to be struck by a firing pin in a firearm so that it will fire. That's what's going to detonate inside the shot shell to cause it to be fired. Out this end, you see it's crimped on this end. This is the end that the projectiles or the pellets that are inside of the shot shell will exit and travel down the barrel of that shotgun.
Thank you. All right, Mr. Greer, the second firearm would be, if you would, talk about a little bit about what the AR platform is.
Sure. An AR platform is something that is commonly seen throughout America. Originally, it was designed by Armalite, and it's just a modular platform, and it's a rifle, a semi-automatic rifle in its normal state, and that's what we have here today.
Okay. And what would be the more common caliber that you might find on the AR platform?
Yes, sir. Typically, what is very common that we see in the laboratory and that you may be more familiar with is it's chambered in .223 Remington caliber, 5.56 NATO. That is a very common caliber for an AR 15 type firearm.
Okay. And what were some of the items that you examined in the case as far as rifle calibers?
In this case, I received one rifle, and it was chambered in 300 blackout caliber.
All right, explain to us what the 300 blackout round is, and maybe how it's similar and different from a 5.56 round NATO.
Sure. Again, you may be familiar with the .223 Remington or 5.56 NATO caliber. The 300 blackout cartridge is sort of similar to that. When that was designed, it was designed so that it could be used with a lot of the original features of an AR-15. So the overall dimensions of those cartridges are very similar, with the exception of a shorter case length and a much heavier or larger bullet.
And 300 blackout being a relatively, at least compared to 5.56 NATO round, were some of the components interchangeable on the AR platform?
It's my understanding that when that 300 blackout caliber was developed, it was designed so that some of the components from the original AR-15 type that were chambered in the 5.56 NATO or the .223 Remington could be used with a 300 blackout.
And it is possible, maybe not ideal, but possible to use a magazine that would be formatted for the .223 5.56 round in a 300 blackout rifle.
Yes, sir, I would say it's possible.
And did you bring any 223 and 556 and 300 blackout rounds with you today for demonstrative purposes?
Yes, sir, I have two.
All right, would you please identify the two and tell us what we're looking at and what the similarities and differences would be?
Sure. To start off, this is an example of a 223 Remington. This is the one that you may be more familiar with. I will show you now, side by side, this is the 300 blackout. I'm trying to do this so you can see. You can see that their overall dimensions there are a little larger. Are about the same, except some, with the exception of the larger bullet. And I'll give you a little bit of anatomy here of the cartridge. What we would refer to as this item right here is an unfired cartridge. Terminology in our firearms department is very key to us in being accurate in what we do. So we would refer to this as an unfired cartridge. That contains a bullet, which is this portion right here, this copper-colored projectile, and that's what's going to travel down the barrel of the firearm towards the target. Again, on this end, just like the shot shell, there's a primer there in the middle. You see the circle object there, and that's what the firing pin is going to strike, so that way it can detonate and cause the cartridge to be fired. When it's fired, we'll have a cartridge case, which is just the brass-colored portion here. And that is the cylindrical component there that holds it all together. It holds the primer, the bullet, and the gunpowder inside of it.
Thank you, Mr. Greer, for your permission to approach. Just yes, for demonstrative purposes, I'm gonna put it on the helmet. Mr. Greer, if you would just pay attention, you have a little video screen there. Let's see if this will work. All right, Mr. Greer, can you see these two bullets on the screen?
Yes, sir, I can see that.
This is not going to work. All right, can you see them clearly?
Yes, sir, I can.
All right. What's the big black thing on the screen?
Appears to be a phone.
In your expertise, that's a fact. The two rounds we see there, the top round, can you identify which one that is?
The one that is up against the foam there would be the 300 blackout caliber cartridge.
And then, as you said before, the round below that would be the 223/556 round?
Yes, sir.
And seeing the actual projectile, meaning the item that exits the barrel of the rifle, would that be that tip, the cylindrical tip on the top?
Yes, sir. And I believe, if I remember correctly, both of those projectiles were copper in color, if you can distinguish that on the screen.
Okay. Thank you. And I don't know if you mentioned it, but I'll ask, as compared to each other, does the 300 blackout have a higher grain typically than the 556?
It's possible. The bullets come in different grain weight, so that is a much larger bullet, so I would expect it to be heavier.
And when we're all going to hear about grain weights, could you explain what that means also?
Sure. Grain is a term that we use in firearms, and it's just a unit of measurement. So when we measure our projectiles, we are going to measure those in grains. And just as a common way to relate to that, if you imagine 7,000 grains, that's equivalent to approximately a pound.
Thank you. So measurements and bullets are done in grains, basically.
Yes, sir. That's what we refer to them in.
Going back to shotgun shells very briefly, are there various types of shotgun shells and gauges or calibers?
Yes, sir, there are.
Could you explain a couple of the types that you might commonly find and then just some of the calibers so we know what we're talking about?
Sure. Some of the more common gauges in shot shell, and gauge is just referring to the size and how we are able to determine what that firearm's chambered in. So a 12 gauge is something that's very common. That's a very common shotgun that I would expect to encounter. You may also have heard of or be familiar with a 20 gauge. That's another one that may be common. Or 410 bore, which is a type of shot shell as well. Those are some of the more common ones that we would see in our laboratory setting and that you may be familiar with. Again, throughout those, there are all different kinds of shot shells loaded with different projectiles, loaded with birdshot, loaded with buckshot, and they all will serve a purpose within within their own respect. But those can have multiple projectiles, hundreds of projectiles. It could have just one large projectile, which we refer to as a slug. So there's lots of options, if you will, within a shot shell.
And although this may be obvious, a buckshot is typically used to hunt what type of game?
I'm not hunting often, but I would expect a buckshot could be used for something, you know, as it suggests, a buck. You would expect maybe a larger animal. Again, I'm not a hunter, but that's where I could imagine that.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. Before we move on, and speaking about the area of forensic science of firearm examinations, is that an area that is subject to peer review?
Yes, sir.
And could you explain to us what that means? What's the peer review process and why that's important in forensic science?
Sure. Within firearms and tool mark examination, this is something that's been around for years. Firearms examiners have been learning about the firearms identification process, building studies and designs and experiments throughout many years. And it's part of that process in designing those studies and doing this research within firearm and tool mark. They're going to draft an experiment, conduct an experiment, publish an article on their findings, and during that process, there can be review, and there will be review of the article of the experiment, where other scientists within our field or other scientists or researchers can examine that and see what was going on during that process and say whether they agree with it and share their comments, and that's part of that peer review process. We, as an AFTI member, I have access to our AFTI journal, where a lot of those peer review articles are published, and they're able for other examiners to look at, for other scientists and researchers to look at, and help bolster or their opinions and thoughts on firearms identification.
And personally, do you know how many exams you've conducted?
I do not have a number of examinations that I've conducted while at SLED. However, at this point, I would say it's somewhere in the thousands.
All right, Mr. Greer, I'm going to ask you, did you receive a volume of items concerning this case for review?
Yes, sir. I did receive several items to examine in this case.
And generally, did you have an opportunity, we're going to go through those items very shortly, but did you have an opportunity to, in general, review a significant amount of items for identification, possible identification?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And did you prepare a report after conducting these examinations?
Yes, sir, I did prepare a report.
All right, I'm going to ask us if we would go through a number of items very shortly. Do you have a copy of the report, and is it needed in order to refresh your memory and be able to specifically recall each individual item?
Yes, sir, I do have a copy, and I would appreciate being able to refer to it.
Okay, very good. And prior to your testimony today, have you had an opportunity first of all, generally when items are submitted, do you know anything about the case?
Generally when items are submitted to the SLED laboratory, I do not have information about the case. I do not.
Prior to today's testimony, have you familiarized yourself at least very briefly with the layout of the scene of the crime?
Yes, sir, I have.
And what specifically paying attention to what on that crime scene layout?
I reviewed a crime scene layout in relation to where some of the marker numbers were that are listed in my report. Those just reference numbers, and I reviewed where those were in relation to the crime scene that the evening where the two bodies were.
And is that just to assist us when we reference item number X, Y, or 1, 2, or 3, it allows us to then to testify as where that was located?
Yes, sir, it can.
All right, Agent Greer, I'm going to go down the list of items, and I'd like you to identify the item that was received mm-hmm. for me, beginning with item numbers 2 through 5. Is SLED item 2 through 5?
Yes, sir.
Your items 2 through 5? Did you conduct a review of that item?
Yes, sir. I did look at SLED items 2 through 5.
And while I find those items, if you would, please explain how you receive items in general, how you receive items in the lab, what the condition is when before you review them, and then what you do ultimately with that item.
Correct. Yes, sir. So as items are submitted to the SLED laboratory, those can come from agencies all over the state, to include our own SLED crime scene department. Those items are given assignments for multiple departments, depending on what the requesting agency is asking to have completed. We are a full service laboratory, so sometimes the evidence has to travel through to other departments before it arrives to me in the firearms department. Typically, if you want something like latent prints or DNA to be processed on those items, it would go there first, because when I get the item, I may decontaminate it or touch it, and those prints or DNA may not be relevant anymore, and because you would find me on it. Evidence travels throughout the laboratory to those departments and through our evidence control department. I receive those items either from those analysts or from our evidence control technicians. And when I receive that item and before I begin my examination, I want to make sure that the item is submitted to me in a manner that I can tell that it's not been tampered with. So we use a lot of heat sealed pouches. So I'll make sure those are sealed, or our cardboard box, that it's sealed up, and I can tell that there's either evidence tape or initials of that sealing examiner prior to me, so that way the evidence has been preserved in a manner that I know no one has altered with it.
And just so we're clear, thank you, Mr. Greer. Just so we're clear, when I refer to items, sometimes I'll say items two. Does that refer to the items that you received them as a SLED designation?
Yes, sir. One other thing about the SLED laboratory, when evidence is submitted to the lab, it receives its own unique lab number that's specific to our laboratory, and it also receives new item numbers, and that's so we can track it throughout the laboratory, and our analysts throughout the lab can report and identify those clearly.
Thank you, Mr. Greer. I'm going to hand you what's been entered into evidence already as State's Exhibits 63 through 68. And I believe they correlate to items 2 through 7 on your report. Would you please take a moment to look at these items and let me know if you're familiar with them.
When we receive these items, I do mark the packaging, and I'm also looking for my heat seal pouch, and this is how I package the evidence after I examined it. So I'm just confirming that I see some of the information on these items. Yes, sir, this appears to be what was submitted to the SLED laboratory as items 2 through 7 in your state's exhibit 63 through 68.
Thank you. And did you have an opportunity? I'll take those from you. Did you have an opportunity to examine these items?
Yes, sir, I did.
If you would, please tell us what your findings were for these items.
I determined that each of those items, they were all fired S&B heads.
Excuse me, Your Honor. I'm renew my prior objection to the opinion testimony. Based upon the hearing we had, just for the record.
Yes, sir. You may continue.
I determined that each of those were one fired S&B head stamp 300 blackout caliber cartridge case, and that was items 2 through 7. That's what each of those items were.
Mr. Greer, an item on the screen in front of you would be what's marked as State's Exhibit 63. Is that representative of the collection of items that you reviewed in that batch?
Yes, sir.
All right. There is your blackout round. Were you able to see the head stamp on it? And I can give you back one of the items if you would. Were you able to identify the head stamp and who the manufacturer of that round was?
Yes, sir, I was.
All right. Who was that?
The manufacturer of items 2 through 7 was Cellier and Bellow, and you may hear that referred to as SMB.
300?
Yes, sir, and head stamp 300 blackout.
All right, Mr. Greer, I'm handing you what's been marked and entered into evidence already as State's Exhibits 33 and 34. Jim, do you want to see those? 33 and 34, which I believe correlate to 9 and 10 on your report. Would you please take a look at these items and let me know if you recognize them?
Yes, sir, I do.
Okay, and please tell us what they are.
SLED item 9, which is State's Exhibit 34, is a fired Federal Premium Double Aught Buck 3-inch Magnum shot shell. And SLED item 10, which is State's Exhibit 33, is one fired Winchester dry lock number 2 12 gauge shot shell.
And after your review of the scene, where were items, your items 2 through 7, located?
After reviewing the crime scene diagram, I was aware of the marker numbers. That those were recovered from, and then reviewing that diagram, it's my understanding that those items 2 through 7, the 300 blackout caliber cartridge cases, were located around or near the body of Margaret Murdoch.
All right, and I'm referring now to your items 9 and 10, States 33 and 34. Where were those at your review of the crime scene? Diagram, where were those identified and retrieved from?
Those appear to be in or around the storage room area near the kennels.
Thank you. I'm putting these two up on the screen. Mr. Greer, are these the items you just testified to having examined?
Yes, sir, they are.
Okay, thank you. Now, right now we're identifying a number of items. Is it would it be fair to say that we're going to go over your results then at the conclusion of the identification?
Yes, sir, we can.
All right, referring to item states. State's Exhibit number 4, your item number 22, would you please direct your attention to that?
Yes, sir.
Marked as and entered into evidence as State's Exhibit 4. Please take a look at this firearm. Let me know if you're familiar with it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this firearm is unloaded. It's safe for me to handle. I will keep it pointed in a safe direction here. I'm going to look for some of those identifying marks that I placed on this shotgun. Yes, sir, I do recognize this shotgun.
All right, tell us what that gun is.
This shotgun was determined to be one Benelli model Super Black Eagle 3 semi-automatic shotgun in 12 gauge with a serial number of U573210E17.
Thank you.
Was there anything that accompanied State's exhibit number four?
Yes, sir. Also submitted with that firearm was an accessory, which was the sling, and one unfired Federal Premium Double Alt Buck 3-inch 12-gauge shot shell, and one unfired Winchester Super X Game Load 16-gauge shot shell.
Now, I think you just testified that 12-gauge, this shotgun is what gauge?
That is 12-gauge shotgun.
And I think you just mentioned that loaded in it was a 16-gauge. Could you explain what the process was ejecting? Is that the proper gauge for that shotgun?
No, sir. The unfired ammunition, as it was submitted to me, was received in another package. I did not remove it from that firearm. However, a 16-gauge would not be correct for use in that firearm.
Did you have to manually remove it from the shotgun?
It was already removed when I received it.
All right. I'm handing you what's been marked as State's and entered into evidence as State's Exhibit 250, Sled Item 8. Sled Item 8, but State's Item 250. Take a moment to review it and let me know if you are aware of what it is.
Yes, sir. I recognize this as Sled Item 8.
Okay. Did you have an opportunity to examine and review that item?
I did.
What did you determine it was or is?
Sled Item 8, State's Exhibit Number 250, was determined to be one fired bullet, and that was listed as a near tire impression at marker 8.
Okay. And you were able to do further analysis, which will get to the results to determine its weight?
Yes, sir.
Very good. So as you testified before, this would be the bullet minus the casing that it originally came in. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is just one fired bullet.
And that's what it looks like when it doesn't have the back part on it?
Yes, sir. That's just a bullet without any cartridge case attached.
All right, Mr. Greer, I'm going to direct your attention to State's Exhibit Number 20, Sled Item 14. Hand it to you and ask if you conducted an exam of this item.
Yes, sir, I did.
All right, what were the results?
Sled Item 14, which is State's Exhibit 20, was determined to be 24 birdshot pellets listed as from dog food storage room.
And can you repeat it for my purposes? These were pellets from what?
Yes, sir. 24 birdshot pellets listed as from dog food storage room.
And you testified before and you presented what a shotgun shell looks like. Would that be what's inside a shotgun shell ultimately?
Yes, sir. That would be an example of birdshot pellets that would be loaded into a shotgun shell.
Mr. Greer, I'm going
going to direct your attention to what's been entered into evidence as State's Exhibit 76, sled item number 12.
Did you have an opportunity to review this item after you take a look at it?
Yes, sir.
All right, tell us what it is, please.
Sled item 12, State's Exhibit 76, was determined to be one fired bullet listed as from bedding inside doghouse.
I'm going to direct your attention to State's Exhibit 102, sled item 11. Already entered in evidence. Please take a look at this item. Let me know if you're familiar with its contents.
Yes, sir. This is sled item 11, State's Exhibit 102, and that was determined to be one fired bullet jacket fragment, three bullet jacket fragments, and one piece of lead listed as defect in ground, gravel, marker 13.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to refer to what's been identified as State's Exhibit 109. Sled item 137. Would you please review this item and let me know if you recognize it and if you performed an examination of it?
Yes, sir. This is a sled item 137, State's Exhibit 109, and it was determined to be one piece of lead listed as from hair on the item 92 dress.
At this point, State would move for 109 to be admitted into evidence. Moving on to State's Exhibit 110, which is sled items 67 and 68. I'll direct your attention to that. It's been marked as for identification purposes as State's item 110.
No objection.
All right, Mr. Greer, I'm going to show you what's been admitted as evidence is 110. If you would, please take a look at it. Let me know if you've recognized it and performed an examination on it.
Yes, sir. State's Exhibit 110 represents two sled items. Sled item 67, which I examined, determined to be 48 birdshot pellets listed as from left shoulder and head of Paul Murdoch at autopsy. And sled item 68 was one piece of plastic listed as from left shoulder and head of Paul Murdoch at autopsy.
Thank you.
When you say where it's from, that's because that's what was identified on the item when it was submitted to you for review?
Yes, sir. That's solely based on how it was logged into our system by the submitting personnel.
All right, I'm going to refer your attention now to three items just to speed along the process a little bit. States 111, 112, and 113 marked as identification purposes. Sled item 69,
66, and 104. So if you please take a look at those in your items in your report, I'll be right over.
Gentlemen, we're going to break for lunch. We will resume in 1 hour and 15 minutes, 2:45.
All right.
That's where this segment of coverage concludes for today. More coverage to come. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss any of our breaking updates and discussion and courtroom coverage on this ever-evolving case. I'm Tony Bruschi. Stay with us.